skip to Luther on Exodus. In Exodus, when the world was now full and sunk in blindness, so that men scarcely knew any longer what sin was or where death came from, God brings Moses forward with the law and selects a special people in order to enlighten the world again through them, and by the law to reveal sin anew. He therefore organizes these people with all kinds of laws and separates them from other peoples. He has them build a tent and begin, so it's called the tabernacle, build a tent and begins a form of worship. He appoints princes and officials and provides his people splendidly, both laws and men, to rule both in body before the world and in spirit before God. For the law has three kinds of pupils. The first are those who hear the law and despise it, who lead an impious life without fear. To these, the law does not come. They are represented by the calf worshippers in the wilderness, on whose account Moses broke the tables of the law. To them, he did not bring the law. The second are those who attempt to fulfill the law by their own power without grace. For the law shows our ability counts for nothing without Christ's grace. The third kind of pupils are those who see Moses, bless you, who see Moses clearly without a veil. They are they who understand the intention of the law and how it demands impossible things. For if Christ's glory did not come alongside the splendor of Moses, no one could bear the brightness of the law and the terror of sin and death. These third kind of pupils fall away from all works and presumptions and learn from the law nothing else except to recognize sin and to yearn for Christ. This is a true office of Moses and the very nature of the law. All right. Let's see if there's any other things in here. What does it say? Liberation theology. Some interpreters treat Exodus politically as a tale about liberating slaves rather than a history of redemption. Critics have questioned the dates and places of the book. Debate has even arisen about the numbering of the Ten Commandments. Oh, yeah. So there's a bunch of controversy around, and we've talked about some of it before, about the dates of the things that happened during Exodus. Who was the Pharaoh during the time? Was it in the middle period? What is it in the early period? Whatever. There's a lot of information going back and forth on that. The authorship, it would be written by Moses. Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible. There's a historical critical kind of approach to it that wants to remove any sort of miracle and any sort of, well, history from the Bible, and kind of says it's an amalgamation of different writers and different authors came together and wrote Exodus, and same thing that they would say about the book of Isaiah, but we don't have to worry about that. We'll just worry about what God actually says in the book. Okay. Let's see, next page has the outline of the book. So Exodus is gonna be a really, I don't wanna say necessarily that it's a law-heavy book. We think about it as a very law-heavy book because that's the book that the Ten Commandments comes to us from. But in reality, in what's actually happening to the people, yeah, they're absolutely given laws, they're absolutely scolded for for not following the laws, and bad things happen to them. But some really wonderful things happen to the people. I mean, once we get to the point where they're slaves in Egypt, when they're brought out of Egypt, there's a lot of miraculous ways this is done. There's a lot of celebration and stuff. So it's not completely a law book. There is a lot of gospel in the book. Although, again, this is where the Ten Commandments comes from. And we'll get to that when we get to that in around Exodus chapter 20 or so. So if you remember, we just ended with the death of Joseph, I think it was, in Egypt. And all of Joseph's family, all of the sons of Israel, who were called the Israelites, all of the Israelites are now living in Egypt because this is where God brought them to protect them from the famine that was in the land. The Egyptians were able to protect them, give them enough food for the time of the famine because God used Joseph to make the Egyptians extremely wealthy and extremely well off in terms of the amount of food that they have. So Egypt has been raised up. However strong it was before, it's been raised up to a much greater power as a result of God and of Joseph. And the Israelites came from the land of Canaan, the land that was promised to them, and they moved out of their land to temporarily sojourn in Egypt, in the land of Goshen. And this is a place where they're not going to stay forever. This is not the promised land in Egypt. So they're looking forward to leaving. All right, chapter 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel. Remember, Israel is Jacob. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his own household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died and all his brothers and all of that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was full of them. So far, so good. Nothing could go wrong. This is how every story goes. Verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh stone cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and all kinds of work in the field. And all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. The fortune of the Israelites has changed from people who are being taken care of by, remember, Joseph is the second in command of Egypt. So these people are regarded as basically royalty. So that's when the family moves in, they're regarded as relatives of the second in command in Egypt. And that changes when you get a new pharaoh and the new pharaoh, and this isn't necessarily the next pharaoh, but this is at some point there was a pharaoh who doesn't have anything to do with Joseph, and he starts oppressing the Israelites. The interesting thing is in response to the oppression, the Israelites just have more babies. And this is something that does sometimes happen in history. Compare and contrast how we live now in a fairly comfortable society where we've got modern medication and conveniences, and the birth rate is usually 2 kids or fewer. Whereas you've got more developing worlds, a lot of times their birth rate is a lot higher. And it's not because they just don't know how babies are made, but rather a lot of times they rejoice in these blessings that God has given them even more. Whereas in our society, we usually focus more on the individual blessings that God gives us of our own comfort. We don't so much consider it as important of a blessing to have children. We don't value children as much in society. Again, you'll see this also with when we're dealing with issues of life, abortion and late life care and stuff like that. So the value for life, even though these people are oppressed, it's interesting. I was watching a movie. So there's a movie called Idiocracy. And you may have seen it, maybe you haven't seen it. In the beginning of the movie, it basically is showing, and it's a very cynical view, it's showing how over 500 years, the entire population becomes really stupid, and all the smart people die off, basically. And they've got these two smart, enlightened people, this husband and wife, and then to contrast, they've got, I think, Cletus and his trailer park of women. And they've got a whole Jerry Springer relationship going on over here where they're just having kids constantly. There's like 100 kids. And then they cut over to this family and they're not having any children. They said, well, you know, it's not the right time to have kids. We want to first finish our college and we want to get ready first. And we want to have all of our affairs in order. We want to make sure that we have enough money and we've paid off our house, we've paid off our cars. We want to make sure that we've taken care of every single possible thing that we absolutely have so we can focus the rest of it on the children. But we cannot yet have children until we are ready for children. We can't have children until we're ready. And then it cuts to, you know, the joke is that it cuts to 10 years down the line and Cletus and his offspring have created more progeny and their family trees, this giant mulberry bush, basically. And then it cuts back to these two people and say, well, you know, we really shouldn't have kids in this economy. Bringing kids into the world when there's so much suffering, when there's so much financial hardship, it would just not be the responsible thing to do. And it keeps cutting back and forth. And they keep having excuses until it cuts back to the family who's the smart family who's being responsible. And the husband has since died. And the woman is like, well, I've frozen some of my eggs and hopefully one day the right man will come along and it'll be the right time and one day I'll have kids and that family line dies off. So this is the explanation of how only stupid people survive. And it's a cynical view to say, you know, well, the Israelites, didn't they know they were being oppressed? Didn't they know they were being a slave? Were they stupid? Why were they having a bunch of kids when life around them was so miserable? And part of the blessing that God gives through children is that even in the depression, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, those who remember history, but in the Depression, was it not true that people were still having kids? And there were still a lot of kids? I've seen pictures of, unfortunately, tragic families in the Depression, where you've got, there's a famous picture where there's a mom sitting out front, she's kind of, you know, got her chin on her hand, and she's got like six kids next to her. Well, is she being irresponsible? Didn't she know that, you know, it's hard out there? Why would she bring kids into the world? And the reality is, I mean, in this case, it's, you know, God's people, they trust God. And they're just saying, you know what, we're just going to have a bunch of kids because this is God's blessing to us. So it's interesting that this is actually a pattern that you see a lot of times, a lot of places where life is less comfortable, where people are more oppressed. You actually see more joy being found in families and in children versus when people are less oppressed, more joy is found in material possessions and accomplishments, entertainment and comfort. And it's an interesting sort of contrast that you would think that the more oppressed, the more beaten down and oppressed people would be, the fewer children they would be having, especially if they were responsible people. But no. Anyways. And this is a good thing, because God did promise Abraham, did promise his descendants that they would build a great nation, as many offspring as the stars in the sky, the sand on the sea, on the shore. And this is obviously fulfilled spiritually with everyone who's a believer, is a child of Abraham, and they can sing, "Father Abraham had many sons, and I'm one of them, and so are you." We're all children of Abraham in that sense, but also biologically. A lot of people were descended from Israel and his 12 kids. All right, so Pharaoh's making their life hard. They just keep having kids. They have more and more and more and more kids. What can Pharaoh do? Pharaoh is upset. He is frustrated. He says, well, if they keep having so many kids, they're going to be so numerous that they're going to be able to take over. They're going to join with our enemies, maybe the Babylonians or whoever at that time, and they're going to rise up in an army. When you've got millions of people, that's very easy to, and they're all connected to each other. They're all considering themselves Israelites, sons of Israel. He's worried that they might overthrow the Egyptians. The Egyptians were not having as many kids for one reason or the other. Verse 15, then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shirpah and the other was Puah, when you serve as a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on this birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him, but if it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded, but they let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this? Why have you let the male children live? This is probably one of the greatest excuses I've heard in the Bible. The midwife said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to a Hebrew you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. So this is the birth control method. Post-birth control, life control method that Pharaoh says. It says, okay, it'll diminish the population if you just kill off all the males. You don't have to kill all their kids, but because they might rise up in that case. But if we kill off all the males, then they'll stop having children who can have more children. An inverted approach was taken in China for a while. You probably heard of the one-child policy before, and I think they've since relaxed it to one child plus if you pay me enough too. They had this problem where they said it was economically irresponsible to have more than one child, so you're only allowed to have one child. Well, the problem is that the last name is only carried on through male children. And in China, part of the culture revolves around this ancestry of carrying on this last name. So when you have a girl, and that's the only shot you have, she's not going to carry on your last name, so she is worthless to you, so you kill her. And then they would keep having babies and keep killing them until they had a male heir. This just evil idolatry of ancestry and carrying on your name, that you're willing to destroy your own children for that sake. But, we've got our own reasons in America that we use as excuses to kill millions of children, too. So who are we to point the finger? The consequence, unfortunately, of killing off one gender within society is that after a couple of decades, now there's no women in China for the men to marry, so they have to go abroad to try to get foreign wives. But then that doesn't keep their ancestry Chinese. Now you're mixing with different cultures and different philosophies and different, you know. So Pharaoh is trying to cause this problem. The Hebrew midwives. So what they said is not true. It's interesting. I've asked people before, what are some of the Ten Commandments? Not everybody has them memorized. And people usually get, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal. But I also hear, thou shalt not lie. Thou shalt not lie is not one of the commandments. Thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor is the eighth commandment. But there is no commandment that says, you shall not ever say anything that's not true. This means that every parable, every fictional story would then be a sin because you're talking about something that's not true. And this isn't the command. But rather, it's bearing false witness against your neighbor. Now, God is a God of truth. He's not the father of lies. So we oppose lies, but lies, I think lies properly understood tend to be malicious and intentionally dishonest in a negative way versus like a surprise party for someone. Like, I'm not going to tell you. You say, is there anything special going on today? No, there's nothing special going on. You walk into the room, surprise, happy birthday. Is that a malicious lie, or is that? I think that there's a difference there that we can recognize, even if it's hard to define. The common example is during the Holocaust, somebody comes to your door and they pound on the door. Are you hiding any Jews in the house? And are you allowed to lie? Does the Bible say thou shalt not lie? Because if so, then you have to tell the SS officer that you are hiding people that you know that they're going to murder. So in this case, it looks like God is commending and blessing the midwives for saying something that's not technically true, and they're saying it for the defense of the children, the defense of God's people, and God blesses these midwives. I just think it's a really funny it's a really funny excuse. It's like, we were going to go kill the kids, but by the time we got there, these vigorous Hebrew women were just, and shooting babies out like crazy. I mean, it's like, I just got off the phone with them, and by the time I drove over, 10 minutes later, they're already holding it. We can't kill the baby once they're holding. So it's just these vigorous. What's really strange to me is that Egypt says, when you serve as a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them on the birthstool, it is a son, you shall kill him. So it's interesting that they say, that they take it as though, well, once the child has been born, we can't kill them then, even though Pharaoh said, well, kill them once they're given birth. And they said, well, we can't. They already gave birth before we got there. We can't do anything. Sorry. It's not really an excuse that holds water that well, but, you know, God blessed them for protecting these children. To the chagrin of Pharaoh. So Pharaoh says, okay, fine. If you can't stop the children from coming out of the womb alive, if you can't perform partial birth abortions, then let's perform post-birth abortions. Let's do that. Let's throw all the men, all the boys into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. All right, and this is how we get this story of Moses, a boy being thrown in, probably placed gently into the Nile. So technically, they did the right thing according to Pharaoh, right? You said to put the boys in the Nile. We put baby Moses in the Nile. Yeah, he was in a basket and he got saved, but we did what you said. Like, it's all that. Technically, we followed you. Okay. Exodus 2. Now, a man from the house of Levi. So remember, Levi is going to be important later on. This is where the Levites are going to come from. The Levites are going to be the religious caste of. They're going to be the people who work in the temple, basically. They're going to be the priests and whatnot. The entire book of Leviticus is all going to be about the laws of the Levites. Now, a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took him in a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it in bitumen and pitch, and she put the child in it and placed it along the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river when her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent her servant, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse from you, from the Hebrew women, to nurse a child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said, "Go." And the girl went and called the child's mother, and Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me. I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and because he became her son, she named him Moses, because she said, "I drew him out of the water." There is so much happening in this text. It's a really clever solution. So this woman is not taking the baby and launching him down the Nile. She's hiding him in the bulrushes. I don't know if maybe she's out in the field working or something like that, and this is kind of nearby, so she can go and check on this kid, and he's just safely hidden in the bushes, in the bulrushes, in the water, or what. But a lot of times I see the depiction of this is as they take Moses and they just float him down the river, and that's not what is going on. He's being contained here in the bulrushes. And I've mentioned this fun fact before. Maybe you remember it, maybe you don't. Moses was placed in a what? In an ark. The Hebrew word in the Bible used for the basket in which Moses was placed is called an ark. There are two other arks in the Bible in addition to this. Do you remember what they are? Noah's Ark and the Ark of the Covenant. So this is interesting that if you want to make the connection between Noah and Moses, I like the joke where the kids and sometimes the adults trick each other and say, how many of each animal did Moses bring on the ark? Well, Moses didn't bring anybody on the ark. That was Noah. But there is a connection here between Noah's ark and Moses' ark here. And God uses this ark in the midst of the water to preserve the one who is inside the ark, whereas those outside of the ark who went into the water died. So presumably Pharaoh was drowning children in the Nile. But because Moses was inside the ark, he survived. And the obvious parallel between Moses is Noah. Noah and his family, they were inside the ark. To them, being in the ark, being in the water, was salvation. Moses was saved from death because he was in the water, safely in the ark. If he had not been in the ark, he would have drowned. If he had not been in the water, he would have been killed. So Moses was saved by the water, which killed others, in the safety of the ark. Same thing with Noah. And same thing with Christians. This is a parallel that's been drawn for thousands of years, that Christianity is seen as, or the church is seen as, the ark. And this is, I mean, not this building in particular, but if you go probably to the Midwest, they do this pretty well. And if you go overseas, a lot of times, not necessarily to cathedrals, but to parishes, a lot of times you walk inside and you look up and there's rafters, and the rafters will be connected like a rib cage with a spine in the middle. The spine is called a keel. It's meant to represent a ship. So a lot of times churches, you're wondering where the shape of a church building came from. A lot of times church buildings were depicted as boats, as arks. So the idea is that you Christians are inside of this ark, inside of the Christian church, not just the building, but Christianity. And because you are inside of Christianity, you are saved by the water, which is baptism, which is salvation for you, whereas those who are outside of the ark, those who are outside of Christianity, are swept away in the deluge of God's wrath. So this is a theme that happens over and over and over again. I don't think in the New Testament anybody specifically talks about Moses in the bulrushes as a comparison, but in 1 Peter 3:21, baptism is connected to Noah's flood. It talks about Noah's flood, then it says baptism, which corresponds to Noah's flood, now saves you, not as a removal of dirt from the body, but as an appeal to God from a clean conscience. So in this, if you want to see a contrast or a comparison to your own life, Moses in the ark, you guys in the ark of the church, Noah in his ark, surrounded by water, which would be dangerous to anyone else, dangerous to your sin, in fact, that's what baptism is, but salvation for you. Now, Moses' mother, in addition to this, this is a great story. If this was just an Aesop's fable, it'd be wonderful on its own, but yes, sir?
I just want to mention, I think the actual ark that was original is a box.
Yes, yes.
So it's a modern mind invention of the...
Oh, for the keel or whatever, the shape of the ship? Yes, so actually that's... There's a couple of other points worth bringing up as well, based on what you mentioned. So Mark brought up that the original shape of the Ark of the Covenant, that's what you're talking about, was in the shape of a box. And if you look at the descriptions, and I don't know, where is it, in Kentucky or wherever they've got the Ark experience? What state is that in? Is that Kentucky? Or, yeah, so I think, I haven't seen it, but I think it's kind of a box shape. There's a couple of different kind of depictions of Noah's Ark. There's a little bathtub version with the giraffe head sticking up out of it. There's ones where it's shaped where you've got a keel where it's kind of curved down. You've got kind of the spines, the keel runs along with the ship. There's ones where it's kind of shaped like a coffin. I like that one the most. I think that's probably the most likely. But there's one feature that should never be depicted on the Ark, however shape you make it, and that feature is a rudder, because Noah never steered the Ark. God never said to Noah, you now, Pope Noah, I want you to steer my church through the waters. But they relied entirely on God to bring them through and to transport them. Likewise, there was no rudder on Moses' ark either. God was the one who steered it. Likewise, when it came to the Ark of the Covenant, there were some problems that came up when people decided that the Ark of the Covenant should go places where God didn't want it to go, where they tried to bring the Ark of the Covenant into battle to use it as a good luck charm. It got captured by, I think it's the Philistines. And the Philistines took it and put it in front of their idol, and a lot of bad things happened to them. There was plagues, and I think their idols got destroyed and stuff, and then they got rid of it. But it's interesting, this how many similarities there are in the Ark. The Ark is not steered by the person in the Ark. Likewise, you are not the one directing your own salvation as Christians in the church. Rather, God is the one who saves you. God is the one who builds the Ark. God is the one who keeps you in the Ark. God is the one who brings the water. God is the one who saves you through the Ark. God is the one who steers the Ark. But yes, so modern depictions of, modern ideas of boats, that's usually what you see. So I guess we could say, you know, the big box churches or whatever, that's the real depiction. If your church is shaped like the Amazon warehouse, that's the more accurate depiction of Noah's Ark. And really, these are the high churches across the street here that we should follow. They just have to get more incense. No, has anybody, so I'm not gonna get too far off, but has anybody ever read Moby Dick, the story? So you've read it. So at the you may recall at the beginning of the story, this is one of my favorite sermons. It's very, very light on the gospel, very heavy on the law. The preacher gives a sermon and he talks about Jonah. Of course he talks about Jonah because it's a fishing village, and I wonder what he preaches on the rest of the year, because he uses the one good fisherman. Yeah. So, but the description of the church in that is fascinating, because inside you've got all these sailors sitting in the pews, and he says he's got masts in the middle of the church, and he climbs up into the crow's nest to preach a sermon. He climbs the rigging up to the crow's nest to preach a sermon to everybody else, and it was as though it was swaying back and forth in the ocean. So they really leaned into the church as an ark, the church as a boat idea with that. But anyways. I love the sermon. It's just, I would have ended it differently. He ends it very dramatically with a thunderstorm, but okay. Oh yeah, so the last thing is, so this woman is not trying to kill Moses. His mother's not trying to kill him. His mother's trying to take care of him the only way that she can, and God ends up taking care of her instead. So she puts Moses in this ark. This ark goes into the Nile. Moses' sister is watching. Pharaoh's daughter comes, finds the child, decides that the child should be adopted. And Moses' sister says, hey, I know somebody who can nurse this child for you. Well, if you don't know too much about biology, women cannot just nurse at random. Being pregnant and postpartum is part of the hormones required for that. So Pharaoh's daughter could not do this. She could not care for this child in a way that somebody who had just given birth a few months ago could have. What a wonderful coincidence. And in addition to that, she's also willing to pay. So now Moses' mother is being paid to take care of her own child until he is an adult. So she gets to raise her own child, be paid to raise her own child, and she has the protection of Pharaoh for her own child. It's a wonderful blessing, a wonderful way that God takes care of this. So that's what happens. Moses grows up in the house. So he's very familiar. This is not like Moses grew up entirely in the palace and he's not familiar with the Israelites. These are his people. This is his family. These are the people he sees every day and he grows up with it. I've got no doubt that he probably met with his adoptive mother many times. She probably visited him a bunch of times. But the people that he sees on a daily basis are going to be the Israelites. So he's going to identify with them because he is one of them. All right, verse 11. One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and he looked at their burdens and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Then when he went out the next day, two Hebrews were struggling together. Then he said to the man in the wrong, "Why do you strike your companion?" He said, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely this thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Have you ever seen the movie Prince of Egypt? They get this entirely wrong. It's a fun movie, but in Prince of Egypt, he is walking or strutting around like he is the Prince of Egypt, and he sees two people, and behold, and he struggles with this guy and tries to take his whip away, and oh no, it's a tragedy. The guy falls off the scaffolding, and by accident, he dies. No, Moses, in the Bible, Moses beats a dude to death. He's like, "Okay, you're hitting one of my people. I'm going to kill you." He does murder a man. He is a murderer. So this is not justified. This is not just. But it's also not an accident. So he intentionally murders somebody. Then he goes and hides their body. And the interesting thing is that the Hebrews, rather than being grateful and saying, "Hey, this guy is a protector of us," they say, "Hey, this guy's a murderer. Who are you to tell us not to beat each other up?" And then Pharaoh learns about this. And again, in the movie Prince of Egypt, he wants to go and he wants to find Moses and talk with him. And "Don't worry, we'll make it right somehow." No, Pharaoh wants to kill Moses immediately. He's like, "Oh, you're killing Egyptians now? Okay, you're going to die." So there's a lot of imagination that went into that movie. And that part in particular, no. Moses intentionally kills a guy, intentionally murders a guy. This is a theme that I keep reiterating. You'll notice that the heroes in the Bible, Moses, David, Solomon, Samson, all of these guys, in addition, David was a man after God's own heart, but he was an adulterer and a murderer. Moses speaks face to face with God, but he's a murderer and he's got an anger problem, as you'll see later on, as might be hinted at right here, or he might just, I don't know, might just have killed a guy. All right, verse 16. Now the priests, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. So he's no longer in Egypt. Now the priests of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and and saved them and watered the flock. So once again, if you're looking for, I think Charlton Heston was probably the best choice for casting for Moses. Moses is a burly character. Moses is a scrapper, a fighter. He's already murdered one person. Now he's fighting off people, driving people away from the well. Verse 18, when they came home to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come home so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his father Zipporah, and she gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." So Moses is recalling that it's interesting that he's considered an Egyptian by other people, but he considers himself an Israelite. He never once considers himself an Egyptian. Again, in contrast to the movie, he's not thinking of himself as an Egyptian, although he probably looks like one. Verse 23, during those days, many of the kings, during those many days, the king of Egypt died. and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. And their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. And God heard their groaning. God remembered his covenant with Abraham and Isaac and with Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. All right, there is some Hebrewism here. One of the Hebrew words, yada, to know. Now, Adam knew his wife, yada, but basically this means to be intimately familiar. So God knew. God was familiar with their suffering. He wasn't far off hearing rumors of suffering, but rather he was engaged in their suffering. He was actively going to do something about it. Now, the people of Israel are crying out to God. God had made promises to them, and it wasn't wrong of them to complain of their situation. A lot of times we think that it's wrong to, you know, we don't want to whine, we don't want to be complainers. But Lamentations is, well, first of all, it's a book in the Bible, but it's also a good thing. It's saying, God, how long will I wait before you will act? Because I trust that you will act. I trust that you will fulfill your promises. So in this case, the people of Israel are crying out to God because they know he hears, because they know he will do something about it. He has the power to do something about it, and he desires to do something about it. And he will. We'll learn about this in upcoming chapters in very fascinating ways. But for right now, we just have this hint that God knew. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Let me see if there's any notes on that specific. I want to see if there's a phrase. So God heard, God remembered, God saw, God knew. Four verbs catalog God's response to Israel's cry for rescue. God knowing always brings about an effect. God understood what Israel felt after seeming to be out of touch and unconcerned. So the idea is that they're calling out to God, you know, and the idea might feel like God is far off because of suffering that's ongoing, but God is not far off, and God hears Israel's cries for help. Likewise, we should never stop crying for help when we need it. When God remembers something, it talks about God remembered somebody, or remember me this day when you go to paradise. The thief on the cross says to Jesus. And remembering is a lot bigger of a connection than just recalling mentally somebody or recalling mentally. So do this in remembrance of me, Jesus says during the Lord's Supper. This is not just think about him like remember the Alamo, but this is participate with me in this event. So God is going to participate and involve himself in the event of Israel's suffering and salvation. And this is what he does when he remembers them. So when we pray for God, God remember me, it's not don't just think about me, but actually act on it. Look at me with love. I'm suffering. I need help. So that is Genesis chapter 1 and 2. We can end there. Next chapter, we're going to get into the burning bush and a lot of other stories that you guys are probably familiar with. But with that, let's close with the doxology.